Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Cast Dice, the podcast that explores the great big wild world of tabletop games that exist today. It's been said once or twice, mainly on this podcast, that we are in the middle of a gaming renaissance. There are just too many good games that we can spend our hobby time and our hobby dollars on, and it can lead to a serious case of not knowing what to play next. And I guess that's the purpose of this podcast. It's to dig into the games that my guests and I enjoy playing, to talk about big industry events, and to talk to the people who create these games. Now, if I go back in time just a little bit, many of you will know that this podcast was just one of many that I've been on over the years. But if you actually go before that, I was a radio DJ for almost 10 years. And the theme song of my radio show was a little song called Pirate Radio. And we had the Jolly Roger hung above the soundboard for every single episode or every single time I was on air way back when in New Orleans in the 90s. There has been a game that I have been looking at for a long time. There is a game that is possibly the most beautiful convention, club night, table game there is. And that there's some stiff competition in that category. There's a game I've been wanting to talk about for a long time. And today we are finally going to get around to talking about Blood and Plunder, the amazing pirate game from Firelock Games. But we're also going to talk about another game that uses the exact same models at a much smaller scale that is even easier to get into. Joining me today is Mike from Firelock Games to talk about Port Royal. Mike, welcome to the show.
How's it going? Thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to talk about it.
Oh, man. I'm going to pull back the curtain a little bit. I have recently got my hands on the Blood and Plunder Blackbeard and Maynard box set. Now, Mike,
yep.
I have bought many core games in my time, and I mean many. However, I have never bought a core game that is that big. It feels like being a kid on Christmas. Can you talk to us a little bit before we get to Port Royal about the history of Firelock and how you got to create one of the coolest core games box sets of all time for the Blood and Plunder game with this massive box?
Sure. Firelock Games was dreamed up by myself and my business partner, Alex Aguila. And the short version of it is I had played another game called Legend of the High Seas back in the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. And Warhammer Historical was like the company that put that out. And they kind of closed their doors. I think GW put a lid on it. And that game kind of introduced me to the idea of playing games where you could actually play on ships and on land and stuff like that. And it was pretty cool. It was basically used, if you're familiar with the Lord of the Rings game, basically mm-hmm. used those mechanics. The sailing was not the best part of the game, but it was functional and it was cool because it was just, you know, you put big ships on the table and who doesn't like that? So anyway, short story long, I started researching pirate history more thoroughly and more realistically and kind of started to develop my own game in the wake of the death of that one. And it was something I was just doing for fun, really. And then the show Black Sails came on TV.
Great show.
And it was a super fun show. And again, my current partner, Alex, who was, we were playing Battletech together, or Alpha Strike, when Alpha Strike was kind of newer, mm-hmm. at our local game store we had just started playing that, and we got along pretty well and had a lot of fun. And we were talking about the show because we both mentioned we were watching it. And he mentioned to me, he said, man, I've never seen anybody do a really good pirate game. And I said, well, as it happens, I've been developing one. Mm-hmm. Would you like to try it? So we set that up. And the very next day, I believe it was, we we got together, and he wanted to play with ships, and I had the ships and everything. We set up a game, we played it, and he completely fell in love with it. Now, he was he's a very he's been very successful in business. He's the co-founder of Alienware. So if you're familiar with Alienware computers, that's his that's where he made his money and how and his learned his and learned business and such. So that's you know that was a super successful company. He had a lot of he had a lot of really important business knowledge that I did not have because prior to that I planned on you know basically wrapping the game up, throwing it online as a PDF or something, and then you know that being that. But he said, "Why don't we?" He said, "You know, I've always wanted to start a miniature gaming company. So, like, what do you think about that?" And we, and I said, "I mean, I didn't have much going on at the time. I had just recently, like a couple years prior, lost a job, and was starting to go back and was finishing up my education. So I said, you know, this is if there's a time to do it, it's now." So, we jumped all in and, the next day, we literally just sat down at his computer and sat and wrote into Google how to make miniatures, and that's from there. You know, we just kind of we launched our first Kickstarter in 2016. Did much better than we anticipated. We were able to work with a lot of really talented sculptors and artists and graphic designers and different people who really helped bring it together, and other game designers as well. Fred Barnard, who came on board and really was critical in helping me complete the rules and making them legible. And you know, just to name one person, but there's a plethora of others. But that was kind of the catalyst. That was the beginning. So when we first started, we had wanted to do hard plastic kits, but that proved to be a bridge too far for us. And we just didn't. We realized it was going to be a massive investment. It was a whole nother level of expertise that we didn't have. So we started out with just metal and resin, and we did that, and kind of with the success we had, we had kind of wished like, man, maybe we should have tried this in plastic. So immediately we started trying to learn how to do it in plastic, and it was kind of a hard thing to learn without being in the industry really and having no contacts or connections. And we were just going to like local companies that were doing that, and then they didn't really have the expertise to do it properly. So, you know, that changed obviously as we started to grow and meet people in the industry and make connections and things. And we connected with a company called Bippy, and they were we felt like they were the right guys for the job, and we worked together with them. And we made the sculpt. Took us a couple years to sculpt that ship alone, that plastic ship. That was a difficult. That was a very challenging thing. There's a lot of obstacles to overcome on that, but finally got it done. Got the box ready, put the whole thing together, and of course, pandemic strikes and kind of messed everything up for us. So we delayed the launch a little bit. Looked like things were getting better in October 2020 when we launched it. But you know, it turns out things were just going to get much worse from there, as unfortunately we didn't know. But so there was a whole long, complicated story there. But ultimately, despite all the setbacks and issues, we did finally get it out, as you can see by the fact that you've got it there with you,
In my
and
hands. Yep.
yeah, that was our always our ultimate goal. We wanted a nice, big, kind of affordable set with all plastic and all the rules and cards and tokens, terrain, etc., all the things you would need to get started. So. That was the culmination of that project. Now we have much more to do in Blood and Plunder. We have many more expansions and things. We plan on taking the timeline all the way forward to like the American Revolution period and stuff like that, and then different parts of the globe as well. So, but I'll stop talking about that now.
Yeah.
You can.
Well, it's when I was a kid, one of my favorite toys, and I know I've mentioned this on the show before as well, so please bear with me, Mike, is that I got the Playmobil pirate ship for Christmas one year. And I worked with my dad, and by worked with, I mean I watched my dad put the complex rigging on this up, and just watching him go through that process. It was magic to me because he was using nylon cord and he was tying things off, but then he was using a lighter to sort of melt the tips so that things didn't unravel while I was playing with it. And as far as I was concerned, this was, you know, this was, as I said, magic. Like it just, it, I'd never seen anyone build anything with fire before. And so I was very excited. And I played with that toy to death. I played with my friends who also had Playmobil kits. But that ship was always part of our play. And so there was always an element of water. And then because of all the other kits that we had, there was an element of land. And so I have really strong nostalgic feelings for a game that allows you, as you say, to have these giant ship-to-ship battles with full 28-millimeter ships, but also to have the scenarios where people are, you know, playing out land-based versus water-based, or even land versus land, obviously. But to play out these conflicts on the tabletop is just awesome. Now, one of the things that pirate games, or at least the pirate mythology post Pirates of the Caribbean, was sort of a fantastical element. And I'll be completely honest, before I bought this game, I for some reason assumed that there was more of a fantasy element to this. But as I opened the box and started reading the rules and started reading some of the stuff on your website and looking closer, this is possibly, as a very passionate bolt action player, this is possibly more historically focused than even bolt action.
Yeah,
pretty wild. Clearly, your background in history is coming to the fore here.
Yeah, and not only history, but I actually sail as well. So that was an important thing to model properly for me, because that's part of the fun for me too. And that's just a personal thing, but yeah, we did. I mean, the so we worked, first of all, we worked with a pretty famous pirate historian by the name of Benderson Little. He was also critical to making Blood and Plunder what it is. Without him, we would not be where we are. In fact, I read he has a book called The Sea Rover's Practice. And that was the book that was kind of the catalyst that made Blood and Plunder what it was. Because prior to that point, you know, most of the pirate books you'll read, history or otherwise, they don't really focus on kind of like the details of how pirates would fight, essentially, mm-hmm. right? Like their tactics, their weapons. They would cover, like, you'll see books and they'll show you some pictures of like cutlasses and pistols and muskets and stuff. But he really went into, and he's a historian. He's a former Navy SEAL officer, and so he knows that side of the business, right? Mm-hmm. So he looked at it. He studied the sources and the history and his own knowledge of conflict and stuff, and was able to really, you know, basically as a war gamer, looking at reading that book, that was exactly what I was looking for. And that kind of sparked the flame for me. And then from there, I was like, oh, man, because kind of before it was sort of, I wasn't going to do necessarily a fantasy game, but kind of more of a Hollywood style game, right? But then when I really started learning a lot of that history and a lot of those details, I just fell so in love with it. I was like, this is actually much cooler than the make-believe stuff. Like the truth is stranger than fiction.
Yeah, exactly.
Is certainly a thing that holds true, especially for this setting and this era. So that was, and by the way, I had the same Playmobil ship, and that was always huge. My kids have, I got my kids one now, of course, immediately. So they play with it a lot too, which is pretty cool. But yeah, that it is definitely very well researched. I mean, the work that the historical work that we did in the book is actually pretty scholarly. We're using, you know, we're digging through primary sources and we're doing all kinds of stuff to really find those really interesting bits of information and history that really just bring the game to life and add a ton of flavor.
So I have to ask, having not put this game on the tabletop yet, with the original Blood and Plunder game, before we get into the other games, it is interesting in that it is focusing on units of models, of infantry models with artillery, obviously in the form of cannons and cavalry, but also how those units interact with the ship, because this isn't like a lot of games that we're used to where you might get one or two people to jump into a vehicle and then they drive it around. A ship takes far more people than just a couple and more time to get it up and running. Was that challenging when you were putting this together as someone, as you say, who has experience sailing? how does that work mechanically?
Yeah, the part that was challenging, because what ended up continually happening, I went through like various iterations of the way the ships worked. They were all pretty similar to what we have now, but there was just certain things that would separate it too much. And it felt like two different games. And that was very much not our intention. Our intention, because we were designing both the land game, the sea game, and the amphibious game as one cohesive game, not just like a different version of the game. And we wanted it to be totally integrated. And that was getting that to feel integrated was pretty challenging. And then the breakthrough moment is when we realized we were just kind of sitting there a little frustrated and talking it over one night at Fred's house. And Steve Soler was also there, who was pretty critical to the whole process. And we were talking, and we were like, well, you know, aren't ships really just like buildings that float around and move? And then once we kind of, that was like the moment they're like, aha. And then we were able to figure it out. So we just tied ships and buildings in together as the same thing and just added the extra layer of the way ships move. And then that was it. We had, from there, it kind of just all came together.
One of the things we love talking about on this show are scenarios, missions. They really do change the way that we play the games on the tabletop. And one of the things that makes this game really unique for me is, as I was looking through the missions, it's not just one particular mission that is set up and played a certain way. Every scenario you have, and there's quite a few in this base book, have a land version, an amphibious version, and a pure sea version, which is really unique and very cool. I am curious to see the process of why, I guess, not just have a table for each type of scenario, but to have every setting set into each scenario is a really interesting idea.
Yeah, so the reason we did that is, again, it was a critical thing, a critical design choice for the game, where we wanted to make sure it was, a cohesive game. So if, you know, thinking about communities and stuff and people coming together and meeting up at a game night or a club or whatever, and you can show up with any kind of force that you have. You could build your force around a ship. You could build your force around land. And if you built your force around a ship and I built my force around a land force, then we know, okay, we can still play against each other, no problem. We're just going to roll. When we roll our scenario, we're going to choose the amphibious version. Or if we both have ships, easy, then we do the same thing. Same thing with land, et cetera. You play whatever version based on whatever you've got. So that way there's no like, you can just show up with whatever you feel like playing with and you'll be able to play.
Yeah, because not everyone does have the ships and not everyone has a mat that might have water on it. So I guess that is very inclusive, right? It's allowing people to play with the toys that they have / want to play with, right?
Exactly, yeah. And some people, we have people who don't like to play the sea games too much. We have people who will only want to play the sea games. So the one who's kind of gets left out is the amphibious games. People like the amphibious games because they're very, you know, they just look fantastic on the table. But people tend to gravitate toward one or the other, but a lot of people will play both. So if you really just want to play your sea list, you can play that against somebody else's land list and it works.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, let's talk about something that's perhaps a little bit more land-based. Of course, we're talking about the whole reason why you're here today. Coming soon in the next couple of weeks to Kickstarter, we have Port Royal. Now, Port Royal is a even smaller version, so to speak, scale-wise, of Blood and Plunder, in that rather than having several units on the tabletop, you will have 6 to 10 models, and rather than activating units of models, you activate individual models. It is the small-scale skirmish version of the game. And while there will be a water version later, which I'm sure you'll get to, when it initially releases, the plans are, and correct me if I'm wrong, that is completely land-based to start.
Right. So even though I initially wrote it to be an amphibious game as well, and I have all the rules, I mean, it's very similar to Blood and Plunder. There's just some differences in the way the models interact with the ships, since you're not moving units and where individual models are placed is more important. But other than that, it's pretty similar to Blood and Plunder, a little simplified from Blood and Plunder. But two things kept me to keep it out to start with. The primary one is that the setting that we chose to start with the whole Port Royal thing. Originally, the game was called Frontiers, and we were just going to kind of do a book only sort of project and just like put a book out, and then you can use the existing Blood and Plunder models and stats, and then use those to kind of like play different sorts of campaigns and different settings and whatnot. But as we started developing the game, and really kind of falling in love with the system, we felt like it needed a little bit. We needed to make it more of its own system that could stand on its own, right alongside Blood and Plunder, because I'm sure there will be people who will play this game exclusively because there's just some people who prefer that style of smaller gameplay. And at the same time, it also kind of opened the door for people who are maybe curious about Blood and Plunder or the whole world or whatever to just kind of jump in at an with an easier buy. And then existing Blood and Plunder players can just get another use out of their model. So it's just it kind of works all around in that regard. But the choice to leave out the ships was I really felt like it didn't really fit the setting, because once we decided to make it more focused on a particular setting, we just felt like because of the narrative nature of the game, the amount of work that we would have had to do to make that all kind of one book and just cover, because the idea was to be to cover different settings and just give you like a little glimpse into this setting or that setting or this idea or that idea. But we felt that wouldn't do justice to the game. So instead, we focused on this one particular setting and location where you could really tell that story in depth, and it's a pretty cool setting, and it's unique. A lot of people don't know about it. We're it is this game does also kind of lean more into the historical fiction. The initial thing that kind of inspired me was like Last of the Mohicans, like having to do something kind of lore along those lines. And in fact, the original game was going to be kind of more focused on French and Indian War stuff, but we figured let's just roll with more like what we've got in our main lines and the whole pirate theme, because that's what we do, right? So let's push it to there. And then thinking about it, landing on Port Royal, reading about the looting and all that stuff, I was like, man, this is, you could just take that and kind of roll with it. And even though there probably wasn't massive street fights among different pirate groups and on the island, and there definitely weren't like Dutch and Spanish and Native Americans raiding at the same time, but that's a cool what if sort of thing. And there's technically no one telling us it didn't happen, so it's good enough for us. So it's but the whole aspect of just the ruined city and the uniqueness of it and still kind of fitting in that historical setting, it was just really cool to us, and we wanted to take advantage of that. So just the next so what we decided to do was to really focus on those settings, and then the next one, the very next expansion that will come out for the game, at least the next major one, will be probably called either Nassau or New Providence or something like that. That focuses on basically, if you saw Black Sails, it focuses on that kind of thing, right? And the whole gist of it is you, and it adds the ship concept, and then the whole gist of it is you build a pirate crew, and you essentially just see how long you can survive as a pirate crew, and how much money you can make before you're either all killed or captured, which was the case for every pirate ever, right? So with very, very few exceptions.
Going back to Port Royal, you bring up the setting and being an integral part of the new game, and you bring up the ruined city. But for those who aren't familiar with the history, the reason the city is ruined was specifically in 1692, there was a massive earthquake that kind of wrecked the city as it was, and everyone who was living there, because there was no infrastructure around it, kind of had to fight for survival slash it sort of threw the entire not always lawful society into a tizzy or into turmoil, right?
So just to elaborate on it a little bit, yeah. So the 1692, you get a massive earthquake. Now, Port Royal, when the English took Port Royal from, or Jamaica in general, from the Spanish, Port Royal was a really ideal harbor because it was deep water right up to the shore. So you could bring in ships and you could hold a bunch of ships in the harbor and load cargo and stuff. And it was also strategically a great place for them to just harass the Spanish from there because it's right along all their trade routes. So, but the Spanish were a little more sound in their architecture and the way they built things. So a lot of the they didn't build so much. They knew that the area was prone to earthquakes and such. So they built deep foundations, well supported. So a lot of the Spanish buildings remained mostly intact. But the English went, and as the town exploded through the results of all the money coming in from all the buccaneering raids and stuff like that were pouring into the town, making it like one of the richest cities in the entire world at the time. They were just building, like they were rebuilding London essentially on right on the sand, like almost no foundation, just right there, like against the beach, just build as fast as they could as the city exploded. So as a result, when the earthquake hit, it caused something called liquefaction, where the sand literally turns into liquid. So people and buildings and things would get sucked down into the ground and shot up out into the air. If you read the accounts, there's a guy who this actually happened to, and he describes it. He was literally just running and he just sucked into the ground, and next thing he knows, he shot up out into the air and somewhere else. And as you can imagine, what this does to the buildings and stuff, buildings are just like perfectly intact, but they're like maybe leaning 45 degrees or something, some weird thing like that. And then, of course, this is followed up by a tsunami. So a tsunami comes in and just brings the harbor into the town. So now all you've got ships laying around the town and stuff, broken stuff everywhere. As you can imagine, I mean, the tables you could build if you're into the terrain aspect. And the game is plays on a 2x2, so it's a 2 foot by 2 foot board. It doesn't take up a lot of space. You could play a little bigger if you want, but it doesn't take too much effort to fill a 2x2 board with all kinds of wild terrain and stuff. And the game's geared very much toward that.
Nice. And this is a game, as I mentioned, it's 10 to, sorry, 6 to 10 models per side, if I understand that right. And as such, because you're playing on such a small board, terrain really does matter. This is not a game that you necessarily want to be playing on a pool table, so to speak, where it's just a big flat open space. Terrain plays an integral part about how this game will run.
Right, and you can play with light terrain if you want to, but it's definitely more fun and interesting when you have all kinds of chaotic things. And there's events that'll happen in the game that can trigger things like everything being so unstable, a building could randomly just collapse while your guys are in there and stuff like that. So,
Nice.
having more things to trigger those random chaotic happenings is always good.
Now, I've been watching a lot of convention events for Blood and Plunder over the years. And there seems to be a lot of people who play it sort of pseudo competitively in tournaments and events like that, and people who are really into the narrative aspect of this. And the game leans both directions. Is that the idea for Port Royal as well, or is that sort of a more of a narrative, come in, let's tell a story, let's build your crew over time, or have them, as you say, everyone get killed or captured?
Right. So, a big thing for me personally as a gamer is I don't like to tell you too much how to have your fun. I want to show you as a game designer, my goal is to let you have fun in the way you want, but show you kind of guide you in that and let you do it your own way. Because some people are just more competitive, some people more narrative. Now, this game is definitely more narrative driven, but that said, I did design it to be balanced and competitive if you want it to be,
Nice.
but not in the and I gotta be careful saying that, not in the way that certain games that I won't name are air quotes competitive, and that just means a bad time for some people. It just means that everything is balanced, that things are thought out so that equal points forces should it should be it should come down to who plays it better, right? So the game has room for a competitive scene if people decide that's what they want to do. But really the narrative element comes in mostly in the post-game sequence, and the integrated campaign system in which your crew will move from game to game, and they may take injuries, or you may take losses, you may gain new members, you may get better equipment, lose equipment, gain increase your wealth and your infamy and your notoriety and things like that.
And with this, you really are, well, how do I say this? Well, the crew aren't exactly no names that don't progress over time. That is not the case. They do progress, but it's the captains and the officers in this game that you're really telling the story of, so to speak.
Right. And the crew, so your crew will have, now regular crew members could end up becoming officers. They could end up kind of through the progression system, there's a chance they could level up if you want to say it that way, and become officers themselves. But yeah, the officers are the ones who are going to have a lot more detail into how you track them. Originally, we didn't do it that way. Originally, we had kind of, it worked the same for everybody. The difference was your characters would level up faster, or your officers. We found that in testing, that ended up being kind of cumbersome to track everything so much, especially when you started getting like to 9, 10 models. So we kind of just simplified that a little bit without taking away too much. The main thing was, the main issue was tracking the injuries across so many models, because as you got deep into a campaign, you would tend to have a lot of injuries and a lot of things to remember. So we kind of put that into the officer section, and crew members just live or die. Otherwise, they're pretty similar. They're still important, and you still name them all and give them, equip them individually and stuff. But the officers definitely are the focus of the storytelling.
Yeah, otherwise that's an awful lot of peg legs and eye patches, right?
Exactly. <yeah.
laughs> Right on. I have to ask, before we go any further, I meant to ask earlier, and I know it's a silly question, but we do love anecdotes in the show. Who is your favorite pirate?
Ooh, my favorite pirate is actually the Steed Bonnet. The one who they just made a show about with Taika Waititi. Mm-hmm. I always remember how to pronounce his name. And I've always just found his story so fascinating because, you know, as the kind of show, if you've seen the show does a pretty good job of kind of showing it. I don't think totally, but to me, I always saw it as like, it would be the equivalent of like modern day, somebody goes to the movie theater and like watches Pirates of the Caribbean and says, I'm going to do that. And buys a ship and abandons their family and sails away to become a pirate with no experience whatsoever, you know. his story kind of shows that, where he goes out and like almost immediately he encounters a Spanish warship. Most pirates in real life see a warship and they're going the other way, but he's like, we're gonna go after them, and gets half his crew killed. Barely escapes with his life. He's massively injured, ends up back in, and he never kind of learns this lesson. He just kind of Blackbeard takes him under his wing and sort of like, I guess I don't know. It's hard to tell from the narrative, but it seems like he just takes advantage of him, since he has a nice big ship and a lot of crew that he could take advantage of to strengthen himself. So, but it's a fascinating story. The man is tenacious, to say the least.
Right on. Well, let's talk about, sorry, I was the one who digressed here. Let's get back to Port Royal.
No problem.
One of the things that I really like the look of in this game is the resource management aspect of it. Because you need to bid using some of your precious resources to see who goes first at the start of each turn, or to improve your chances of who goes first, I should say. But then
Right. You,
by doing that, you have less resources to spend over the course of the turn, which is a really fascinating game mechanic. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because that is, I think, a really big selling point for this game and what makes it really cool.
Sure. So that actually conceptually comes from Blood and Plunder. So this game and Blood and Plunder share some mechanics, but they're also very different games. But even though they're very different games, they share a lot of concept. Pretty much all the concepts are shared between both games. So the difference is, when I started to make this game, the concept was, okay, so what I'm doing here in this game is I'm basically getting one squad out of a Blood and Plunder army and making that into an entire army.
Mm-hmm.
So how does that look? So in Blood and Plunder, we have a card activation mechanic, which has a similar thing. You basically have a hand of cards, and all the cards have suits, and those suits have an initiative order. Higher suited cards that are more likely to go first give you less actions for your unit, and lower suited cards that make you more likely to go last give you more actions. I think I said that right?
Yeah.
Higher suited cards, less actions. Lower suited cards, more actions. But higher suited cards, higher initiative. Lower suited cards, lower initiative, etc. So and that's kind of the whole thing. That's a big part of the system that drives Blood and Plunder. It adds a lot of again, resource management and tactics to the game. So this is the same thing, but instead of going back and forth like we do in Blood and Plunder, since it's more of an army game, in this game it's more along the lines of I wanted to make it play a little faster. So the idea is to keep games right around under an hour, like 30, 45 minutes, which it does. So because of that, it's an I go, you go. So you're going to go with your whole force, and I'm going to go with my whole force. The trick being there's reactions in the midst of that. Now, in Blood and Plunder, to shadow or to make the analogy with Blood and Plunder, basically by spending more of those resources, which we call fortune points, in the start of the turn to gain that initiative to go first, which is a pretty big advantage, even though you can be reacted to, but you kind of have the edge. But you're able, but your attacks are probably going to be less effective, and you're going to have less options because of your lesser resources. So those resources could give you rerolls on your dice, they give you extra actions for your characters, more deadly attacks, things like that. But then, even if you're so even when you're on the down foot in that way, you do have the ability to spend more resources than to kind of combat the player who went first. So it keeps it interesting because there's certain times you kind of don't want to build, you kind of just want to let your opponent go just because you don't have a good opportunity. But there's other times where you really want to capitalize on an opportunity. So it's all about maintaining that balance, and just like in Blood and Plunder, but kind of in a more simplified way.
Yeah, activations is a big thing we like to talk about on the show as well. And you've done a great job of explaining how Blood and Plunder works. But I also want, I know you've talked about Port Royal, but let's also go back to that as that's the game I guess we're mainly talking about. With that, as you say, it's you go, I go. So you move your whole force, I move my whole force, but you interrupt people with the reaction system. Now, people always ask, well, doesn't that slow down gameplay? There's a limited number of reactions, if I understand this right, that someone can make during the course of the turn, and that affects gameplay. Am I getting that right?
More or less, yeah. So the way it works is you can react to a model that's activating one time. So however many models you, so if you're going first and I'm the reactive player, if you have, let's say, seven models, that means I'm getting a total of seven reaction opportunities or potential ones because you still got to roll for them. So you may not always get the reactions, where that's where your rerolls and things come in and become important. But so it's not, you can't react to every single thing the opponent does. You got to choose where you do it. So for like a model could potentially take up to three actions. So you choose at which point. So if you react to the first action and you fail or not, you can then no longer react to the next two actions. So a lot of times there's, again, there's some more tactics there where you can kind of fake some things, and then you have, and then to throw an extra twist into that, you have your commander, whoever the commander of your force is, he can give his actions to models that even models that have already gone. So sometimes you could do some setups with that and some coordinated attacks and things that can kind of upset that balance. So it's, again, it's just a lot of choices to make in how you spend those resources between your points and your actions.
And you talked about rolling to see if you're successful. That depends on the veterancy of the unit that is going on, and that plays into how you build your force as well. So you need to consider that as you are building your forces to put on the tabletop.
Exactly right, yeah.
Well, Mike, coming up in a couple of weeks, we have the Kickstarter for Port Royal. I do have some questions about how that will lay out, because every time you look at a Kickstarter, you have different options, obviously, to buy. And you can just get a rule book, you can get miniatures, you can get boxes. That's typically how we see games like this rolling out. Now, because Firelock is a smaller company, a lot of the success of the products that you've put out in the past have been dependent on Kickstarter. That you're not a massive Games Workshop style company that's doing this just to make extra money. You guys really do depend on Kickstarter to put out some of your big games. Can you talk to us about maybe a little bit? I know that Kickstarter and fulfilling things is always difficult in the post-COVID world. We understand that, particularly in Australia. However, how is this game going to look on the Kickstarter page when people look at it, and what is your overall goal for fulfillment?
So first, I'll make a quick note on the date because I've been all through Adepticon. I told everyone it would be late April, but we've had to do some staff shifting internally, so that has created a little bit of chaos. And we decided not to launch a Kickstarter in the middle of that, so we're actually pushing it back to the end of May is when we're going to launch the project. But the project, once it comes out, so if anybody saw, we recently did in October. We did, I think it was October. Pretty sure it was October. Anyway, late last year, we did a Kickstarter for a game called Blood and Crowns, and that was that. That Kickstarter was sort of experimental, and it worked out really well. So, I had kind of sworn off Kickstarter. There was a previous interview I did last year, or the year before. No, it was last year that I said I'm out of the Kickstarter game. It's just too much. It ends up we're a small, like you said, we're a small team, and it just kills us to do these massive projects, and they're just crazy, and they overwhelm us, you know. And it's and we get them out, but it's I mean it's I it's, I lose a lot of sleep. My beard used to be brown, and you know, so I just so we decided not to. So anyway, we swore off Kickstarters, but then I kind of realized maybe we're just approaching it wrong. So we decided to do this project where we did a rule book, we did a handful of miniatures and STL files. I think it was like four miniatures, I believe, and a ship model, an STL ship model, a couple decks, and a punch board token set, and then some of the accessories that we currently sell already. And that worked out great. Even though we had some issues with all the stuff with the canals, you know, there's no canals, there's no water in the Panama Canal, the other canal is blocked, so you know, there was a lot of delay in in freighting it over here. But even with that, our goal was to ship in January, or to start shipping in January, and we ended up shipping in March. So by Kickstarter standards, that's basically early. So,
Yes.
but and that's because it was a smaller, more manageable project. And by the time we got to the point of launching the Kickstarter, we were ready to tell the printer go. It was just a matter of funding it. So that's exactly the way we're going to run this one. So the idea is this is going to be a pretty lightweight project compared to, like, this is not going to be like Raise the Black, where there's a ton of stuff. We're going to have our starter box. We're going to have a book option. We're going to have some punch board, extra punch board terrain aside from what's in the box. Because as we talked about, terrain's important. So there's going to be a lot of terrain, a lot of good stuff in the box. We're going to have a deck. An activation deck for the solo and co-op version that controls the which you don't, it's an optional thing. You could just use regular playing cards, but the deck makes it a little easier. We're gonna have the deck and a handful of models, and that for the most part, I mean, that's the whole project. So we are using existing tools that we already have. So if you have the same models that are in your Blackbeard starter set, the same models that are coming in this box, as well as an extra sprue, probably it's going to be one of our early stretch goals. I'm sure we're going to hit it. Where it's like just an extra sprue with some extra characters, like a priest, a commander, some casualties, and some chests and barrels and sacks, and a monkey and a parrot, and just fun stuff to like decorate objective tokens or your model bases or whatever you want to do. Excuse me. And so that's pretty much what the project's going to look like. And it looks like the box will probably end up being right around $99. I'm still waiting on some final quotes for that, but I should have that here in the next. I was hoping to have that already by now, but I'm literally in the next day or two, I should have that information locked down. But that's what it's going to look like. And we're shipping everything from here. That in the past, that's always been a major issue, was trying to do overseas fulfillment. And I know that that's a little more expensive for some people, sometimes, especially in Australia and Europe. But with Blood and Crowns, and again, because it's not a ton of stuff you'll be getting in this project, it's pretty lightweight in comparison. The fees, the import fees and stuff are going to be more manageable than on a giant project, right? And but doing it from here, I mean, we shipped the entire Blood and Crowns Kickstarter, which is over like 700 orders, in less than a week. So that just, I think that is worth it. I mean, every time we've worked with somebody with another company to do fulfillment outside of here, it's always been a mess. They've just not done a good job traditionally. And I get it, it's a hard thing to do. You're getting somebody else's product and organizing it, but there's always problems with SKUs and mixing things up, and then they take forever because they're your it's your project and 100 other projects that they're working on at the same time. And really this way has just worked a lot better for us. And for a lot of for some countries, there's going to be the option to pay the fees up front, so there's no surprises. It just comes right to you. We're trying to do more of that if we can, where the system, the shipping system allows us to. So, but that's how the project is going to go, and I think it's going to be. And again, this is a project that's it's just about ready to hit go once it's just a matter of funding it. We're taking advantage of the extra time, just doing some extra play testing. And just tweaking and seeing what we can come up with in the next, in the next like 15, 20 days before we launch the project. But I mean, it's mostly finalized at this point. And once it's ready to go, we're going to be fulfilling this, and it'll be out by the fall. So by the end of the year, this will be out. So right, I can't say a date just yet because again, I haven't talked to the printers, but I know it's going to be out this year. Like even if it's delayed, it'll be like worst case scenario. You're talking about maybe January if things get really bad. But still, by Kickstarter standards, less than a year is always good. So.
Yeah, exactly. Well, as someone who recently picked up, as I said, the Blackbeard and Maynard box, I was very excited to hear that not only is there a new game, and it uses fewer models, so it's easier for me to paint and get on the tabletop, but also it uses the same models as far as scale wise. And as you said, some of the same models will be across both games, but it also means that for people who are incredibly slow painters like me, I can start getting my grubby paws on miniatures. In this case, I already have them in front of me. I can literally start building them and painting them. And so I can be ready for when the game launches. And as I know, for example, that I know the setting and most of the people who are there, I can start painting up the pirates for my set as the Jamaican pirates, and I already have the British to be the British. So, between the two games, it seems like this is a really easy game for people to pick up and play, particularly if they already have some of the core elements from Blood and Plunder.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's going to be a handful of new models, just like kind of individual model sprues that we're going to make in-house, that are going to be geared toward your command figures, so you can kind of customize them. So you have a bunch of weapon and head options and stuff like that, so you can just get a little bit of extra stuff aside from what we already have out there now.
Yeah, brilliant, man. This is very exciting, and I think like hopefully it just means a lot of new players will be able to, get in with Port Royal and then go, you know what? Maybe I do want to put a ship on the table and then,
That's the hope.
build up. Awesome. Well, Mike, I know that we had to sacrifice a few things for your evening for you to come on today, and I really appreciate that. But I am so excited for both the Kickstarter for Port Royal and to be being able to play Blood and Plunder myself. So, thank you for taking the time, brother. This has just been awesome to have a chat, and wish you all the best next month with the Kickstarter.
No problem. Super happy to be here. Thanks for having me, and I appreciate it. I hope you enjoy the game.
Oh, definitely. Man, I'm already enjoying it, and I haven't even, rolled dice yet. I guess the next question is, where can people find out more about Blood and Plunder, and where can they look next month at the end of May for Port Royal?
So, firelockgames.com, that's your main place you're going to want to go. You can sign up for our newsletter there. We're also on Facebook, Instagram. We have a Discord server that you can find through our website there in the community tab. We've got a bunch of other games based on the Blood and Plunder system you can check out there too. We have Blood and Steel, which is Victorian age stuff. We've got Blood and Crowns, like we just talked about, which is 100 Years War. Blood and Valor, which is a World War I game. And we've got Oak and Iron 2, which is our 1/600 scale. It's kind of like the simplest explanation I can give is it's X-Wing with ships.
Yeah, and it's sort of
Although not really,
it's
but yeah.
zoomed out. Yeah, so if you want to play with little ships and lots of them, Oak and Iron is your game.
That's right. Yeah. So that's again, firelockgames.com is the base, that's the hub. You'll get everything there. But we're also on Facebook, Instagram, all those things. And there's a bunch of excellent community blogs out there: Blood and Pigment, Timber and Sale, Dead Man's Chest, The Plunder Dan. There's probably some I'm forgetting off the top of my head, but there's a bunch out there. We have an awesome community. I mean, I can't say enough good things about our community. The stuff they do, Summer of Plunder. I almost forgot to plug Summer of Plunder. Every year, our community, and this is, they do this completely separate of us, but obviously we support them totally in it, and we're actually sculpting some stuff for them this year so we can have a little bit of extra support. We do a Summer of Plunder event, which is, it's a mix of painting, and there's a, it's a campaign integrated with Blood and Plunder and Oak and Iron, and they, you'll see they create a map, and they fight for territory, and you've got pirates raiding each other and stuff, and it's all integrated online through the Blood and Pigment website and some of the other community groups out there too. They all contribute and work together toward it. So definitely check that out if you're interested in Blood and Plunder. If you're new to Blood and Plunder, I know there's a lot of you. We've been selling two player starters that sets like crazy lately. So I know there's lots of new people out there. This is an excellent opportunity to just get together at your store, your club, your friend's house, whatever it may be, and just join the community and participate in that event.
Yeah, and if, guys, if you have not checked out Blood and Plunder before, I know that I hadn't been to the Firelock Games website and really dug in until I got the box set, but damn, does it look good? It's definitely worth, even if you're not like, I'm not into historical, I'm not into pirates, blah, 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 take a look. The tables, as I said in the intro to this, the terrain, when this game is on the tabletop, it is not only eye-catching, it is eye-grabbing. It drags you over by your nostrils to the tabletop and makes you look at it. It is phenomenal looking. It is worth a peek. Although I warn you, the wallet comes out sometimes when you start looking. So I had a few people recently message the page saying I'm a bad influence because people keep buying games that I talk about. I assure you, I am the biggest victim of that on this podcast. However, yeah.
So am I get
it. Right on. Well, Mike, again, thank you so much for making the time today. It has been an absolute pleasure. Go to firelockgames.com, ladies and gentlemen, and check things out. And of course, at the end of May, look for Port Royal on Kickstarter. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for listening. As always, I did have a request to talk about Blood and Plunder at one point. I am sorry, it took a little while. I did want to get the core game before we had anyone on to talk about it. I unfortunately had not had a chance to actually put it on the tabletop yet, but damn, does it look good. So I'm hoping to get some games of that in the next month or two. But of course, this was a request. If you have any other game requests to talk about on this podcast, please go to Cast Dice on Facebook. Message me there. You are guaranteed a response, and I would love to hear from you. Ladies and gentlemen, as our buddy Casey always says, we hope that your dice roll hot. We hope that your beverages are cold. But more than that, as you are playing the games that we know and love, I hope that you are having fun. Stay safe out there, ladies and gentlemen. Good night.
are gone, and they're tracked by hungry hounds. The movie's gone, and they tear my